Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host and the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement and the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. Today, I want to give a brief overview of what we'll be talking about, but also give a content and a trigger warning, as viewer discretion is advised due to the nature of conversation that we'll be talking about. Today, I'm bringing in one of my friends and one of collaborators of the Rise Above Justice Movement, Britt Koch, who's going to be talking about the decolonization of self-care. So, without further ado, Britt, would you like to introduce yourself and talk about what decolonizing self-care looks like to you? But, well, actually, first, let's roll back. We're going to talk a little bit about your experience as an educator and as, you know, doing these planned drills of school shootings, like active shooter drills, and walk me through your experience as an educator, what inspired you to get into education, and then we'll just do a deep dive into self-care and violence prevention.
I'm Britt Koch. I am Indigenous. My tribes are Choctaw and Oto, Missouri. I'm based in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I work in decolonization of self-care and making that accessible to all who are willing to learn. I was a former educator in Arizona. I taught Montessori schools, mostly kindergarten through third grade, kind of varying on the year, as well as being a director for the middle school campus of our school system, which was super fun. I really do like those middle schoolers, but that kind of leads into harder conversations and kind of different concerns than we have at the lower education level. We're talking a little bit about gun control and school shootings today due to the recent one in Minneapolis. And we just want to bring to light the perspective of what an educator experiences in that. What we focus on after that happens is parents and children, which is obviously rightful to do. But I think a lot of people forget the perspective of teachers and support staff during that experience of trauma. And how do you walk into a building where students you knew or taught were killed? Kind of what that, just how I feel about that, because there's not a lot of conversation on that perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. So what inspired you to get into education? What inspired you to train our future generations to become leaders, become advocates? And what do you think happens whenever these institutions continue to fail our students? We have like a school to prison pipeline. We still have like a lot of other things that are going on in our school systems. But something, you know, as you stated, something that's not being very talked about very much is the educator perspective on gun violence and the school shootings.
Yeah. So I got into teaching after studying art and teaching elementary education. I really kind of always loved teaching, and I was always like a nanny or a babysitter, and I'm the oldest of four kids. I enjoy kind of the role of teaching, doing fun, exciting things, trying new things. And so it really kind of felt like a very just like easy path to follow. I really enjoy education. I love seeing kids get excited about learning how to read, science, really any interest that they have. The school system that I worked with was really amazing. It was in Flagstaff, Arizona, at a small Montessori school. So we did a lot of stuff outside, and it was kind of like whole child focused. So it wasn't just the type of education that a lot of people are maybe used to as far as public schools go. So that really excited me as well. I did not continue teaching when we moved to Oklahoma, where I am from, to be closer to family after COVID years. We wanted to be closer and just be able to experience family. And so that brought us back to Oklahoma. But the school system here is pretty rough. I don't know if you guys have heard of Ryan Walters, but he is not doing great things for us here. So I decided to step away from education a couple of years ago when we moved back. But moving on to just kind of what it was like to be in the classroom when we were having to kind of talk through drills and essentially like rehearse trauma-inducing things, and the reality of what it feels like to be a teacher or administrator in those situations of thinking of safety plans and all that goes into planning these drills and hoping that you will never, ever have to do them, but recognizing that a lot of thoughtfulness goes into it so that everyone potentially could be safe if this were ever to go down at your school. It's a really interesting mental load because you really come to love students and families and the community that's formed, especially as a teacher. Just getting to know how wonderful your kid or, you know, the kids in the class are, it happens very quickly because you're spending a lot of condensed time together. And it's really hard when you're doing these drills to just like recognize the fact that you would literally throw your body in front of them if need be. I'm a visual person. So I just kind of go back to being in the classroom and like thinking about actually doing that and explaining it to kids and having to talk through this hard stuff with especially the first through third graders, and them kind of like recognizing why we are doing it.
Absolutely. And, you know, I can imagine, I have some teacher friends that I'm still connected to that actually taught me, you know, whenever I was going through the public school system. And one of the things that they really talk about, you know, on their social media is like the teacher burnout. And I want to walk over really quickly from a source from NEA Today. And on April 7th, 2025, they released an article that is titled "What's Causing Teacher Burnout?" And then the byline is "Stress and exhaustion is pushing too many out of the profession, but it's not up to educators to find better ways to cope. The responsibility to improve working conditions lies with those lawmakers and officials who dictate what a teacher's day looks like." And some of the key takeaways, you know, as outlined in the NEA.org article is, number one, many school districts are still struggling with staff shortages, and more educators are feeling burnt out and demoralized. Two, higher pay always helps with teacher retention, but improving working conditions, student behavior especially, has moved to the forefront of educators' concerns. And then last but not least, number three, is lawmakers have not done enough to alleviate the crushing workload and undue stress that is pushing too many teachers out of the profession. Educator and their unions are working to change that. But the one thing that's not really mentioned in this is the debilitating factor of how many school shootings have happened. I mean, look at Columbine, look at Parkland, look at Uvalde, look at, you know, countless others. And this most recent one at a Catholic school in Minneapolis. What's your reaction to the teacher burnout rate? Because it's not a surprise. You know, I saw whenever I was going through education, you know, a lot of my teachers started feeling, you know, they started feeling really burnt out. They started feeling really depressed. You know, whenever it would come to their lunchtime, you would walk by their classroom, you know, heading to your next class, because we all took, you know, different lunch schedules or whatever. And you just see them having their glasses off and just laying their head on their desk. What is your reaction to that? Because the current statistic is 44% of American K-12 teachers report feeling burnt out often or always, you know, per statistics. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I think that's totally believable. It's a very thankless job. And like I was kind of saying earlier, just the mental load of the safety of children. And then when you bring into the factor of all of these occurrences of shootings happening at schools, it's really hard to get that out of your head as a teacher. And also kind of just like, I don't know. It's almost like a forced numbness that you kind of have to get into, because it's very hard not to picture that happening at your school, or if there is some sort of like agitated person, in the community, it's very hard not to like go there in your mind, on top of everything else, as far as like, just everything else that goes along with teaching, the actual planning of it, the follow through of teaching the lessons, all the planning that goes into everything in your classroom, what the kids need, all that stuff. It's a lot. And at this point, something I've been like thinking about and thinking on is that teachers really, I think, deserve some type of hazard pay. At least until lawmakers decide to make some sort of change when it comes to gun laws and gun control and gun sense issues.
Yeah, no, 100%. And upon doing like research, like from sandyhookpromise.org, this is an organization that I refer to a lot in like the gun violence prevention aspect. And they have a part on their website that talks about Black, Indigenous, and people of color. So BIPOC communities are disproportionately impacted by gun violence and mass shootings. On, thinking about that. And thinking about how a lot of states do not have like a hate crime statute, how do we as a society recognize the need for common sense gun laws? It's a very deep and loaded question because there's a lot that goes into it. And I can start by saying Black youth account for 38% of all gun homicide fatalities in 2020. Even though they represent only 2% of the total population in the United States, Black children and teens had the highest gun death rate in 2019, followed by American Indian and Alaskan Native children and teens. And all these statistics are directly from Sandy Hook, during their research. And then 4,100 Latinx or Hispanic people die to gun violence every year. And then Hispanic and Indigenous people are more than twice as likely to die by gun violence than their white classmates. These statistics are alarming.
They truly are. Just kind of like off the top of my head, thinking right now is, I wonder if these communities that these deaths and gun violence issues are happening is honestly just a piece of, I don't know how to word this, but sort of like the races that are continuing to face racism and scary issues, say with police, or just like hatred from other races. Like, do they have more guns than others? Like, are these deaths children? Are I don't know. I'm kind of like thinking as I'm speaking, but like, are the statistics children, or is it just like anyone in that race?
It appears these are more geared directly towards student-wise, but
Okay.
upon like looking at more of it, it's kind of like it's a very broad scope because we know that marginalized communities are disproportionately affected by violence, and it continues on this like national trend, and it keeps going and going and going.
And I wonder, it makes me wonder, like, is it because more of those marginalized families and communities have guns because they're worried about other types of retaliation or protection issues? I mean, that's what it makes my mind go to.
Yeah, 100%. And I think some of the other key statistics to kind of take away from this is there were 1,375 school shootings between 2000 and 2001 and 2021 through 2022 school years, resulting in 515 deaths and 1,161 injuries. And 2021, 2022, 2023, and 2024 have all seen high numbers of school shootings. With the school year of 2021 to 2022, school year being one of the deadliest. Since Columbine, specifically, over 420 school shootings have occurred across the United States since the 1999 Columbine shooting. And thinking about like the student exposure to school shootings, since 1999, at least 39 or 390,000 students have been exposed to a school shooting. I can attest and say that in 2011, there was a shooting down the street from me at my middle school. And I remember being on lockdown and not being able to get a hold of my mom, not being able to, the final bell rings, but they're like, wait, don't pay attention to the bell. I need you to stay in your classroom. These doors get locked. You can hear police running up and down the hallways. You can hear dogs sniffing underneath the doors. And I remember, my heart feeling like it's about to pound out of my chest. Here I am, like a 13 or like 12 or 13 year old child. And then fast forward to high school, there one of my classmates shot and killed somebody outside of our school. And again, we went on lockdown again. And I can remember that. So walk me through, and we'll kind of jump into like self-care and like the decolonization of self-care. This is a perfect segue directly into that, because how do we help these students after a mass casualty event takes place? What is the best way that we can decolonize that self-care and go back to the original roots of self-care, like in the 1960s and 1970s, healing and sustainability, and then also, community focused before colonization. And it gets whitewashed, it gets watered down. Walk me through how do we as a society prevent this tragedy from happening and to continue going? But most importantly, after that tragedy, how do we help students heal and how do we help them find their voice to advocate for policy changes?
Well, that was a lot of questions. Let me organize my thoughts for a second. As far as like how do we prevent the tragedies, I do think if every single gun owner had to go through some sort of mental health assessment before they had a gun, and if they had to have insurance on owning a gun and using a gun, then obviously insurance companies would lobby for stricter and safer gun laws. So I think that would be like a practical thing that could happen is that gun owners need insurance, because then you could have the insurance companies fight for us in that way. As far as like what can you do after something like that happens? I mean, gosh, it's so loaded, especially now being a parent as well, to a child in elementary school and having the experience of being a teacher and running these drills and helping students kind of understand why and how and the importance of doing those for safety measures that hopefully you would never ever have to use. It's just it's hard to imagine as a teacher how you would go back into that building and do your job after something like that happened. And obviously for the students and families and all the teaching staff that is affected. Gosh, of course, therapy. And if you're going to look at it through the self-care lens, I feel like you have to recognize what self-care is actually meant to be versus what we've been taught. As far as in our Western American culture, that it's buying things, it's pacifying your emotions by treating yourself or by doing like fancier things like a massage or, some sort of like facial or going to expensive yoga classes, that essentially self-care is meant to be more communal and that it can be filling your cup, grounding yourself, and taking time to give yourself real, true, deep care so that you can pour into your community, and you can participate in things like activism and encouraging others and maybe taking loads off of other people so that they could also take deeper care of themselves. I mean, I think that's really the path forward in general, that I would hope to see a swing in our just like American mindset of what self-care is, so that we can do bigger and better, greater things for each other and participate in more of a community-minded reality than we have been.
Absolutely. And whenever we think about colonization of self-care, we think about, the political roots of it, but also we think about individualism, and we're told to just to pick yourself up by your bootstraps and continue moving forward after, or, we oftentimes hear like thoughts and prayers after a mass casualty event. How do we as a society overcome thoughts and prayers and advocate for policy and action? And then we'll do a deep dive into, what you wanted to talk about with the decolonization of self-care. You can walk us through like your inspiration behind that, and but let's start with the how do we move from thoughts and prayers to policy and action?
So that's actually what I write about in my ebook called Reclaimed and Radical. It sort of walks you through decolonization of self-care so that essentially you can resist in a way that is sustainable. So I don't know if you know, but Native Americans were almost all murdered or died of, miscellaneous diseases that were not present here before colonizers came. So, we in general are resistors. We have a lot of resilience, and I think it is kind of ingrained in me to problem solve and make it through issues and try to help others do the same. And so, in writing Reclaimed and Radical, I really wanted to help people get into a mindset of taking care of themselves so they could take care of others. And so we could handle business that needs to be handled, which is, essentially lobbying and activating people towards policy and change and getting out to vote and helping people kind of understand the issues and encouraging people to get into local politics. Like, it's not just presidential elections that we should be focused on. Big things happen, on the community level as well and can ripple out that way. So I think in general, if you are taking care of yourself, you're going to have room and mental space to sustainably resist and be active in your communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And you, I need to sit down and read your ebooks because these are deeply rooted in, common knowledge. And, well, I guess we would think it would be common knowledge. We want it to be common knowledge, but it's not, right? Because, or else why is these ebooks would not have to exist because it would already be ingrained into society. But whenever
Right.
we think about decolonizing self-care, where do you envision and how do you envision people plugging into that work? What can we do as a society to get back to the original roots of self-care? Because it's deeply grounded in like community focused and that healing and sustainability. How do we go from colonization back to decolonization, that before times?
Right. I mean, I think it's important for people to look to Indigenous and Native creators and voices that are out there. I know it might not seem like there are a lot of us. And to be honest, when I started creating content a year ago, I didn't see many voices. And I think it's because it's so easy to connect with people who are, focused on individualistic needs, which is like not bad. Like obviously we need entertainment. We like recommendations for, shows or like, I can't think of any other things, but and a lot of cooking content and just other things that are out there. And so I just like didn't know there was sort of like other people who shared my like sort of vision and excitement towards decolonization, because it is so ingrained in our American mindset that everything can be sold and will be sold and is often taken from other cultures and manipulated into things that it like wasn't for and appropriated. And I guess I just like have a really big passion into helping people find ways to connect to maybe their ancestry and their cultures, what they may have used instead of, say, like smudging white sage for cleansing, like what were herbs in their region that they used for the same type of things. Like a lot of culture, going back to beginnings, like a lot of things are similar in cultures as far as like being communal or being, involved in families and like multi-generation living and, cleansing with herbs and using environmental things to like heal you, because we're humans. We a lot of that comes from all different cultures around the world. But like, how can we now, as a society, ha that we have access to so much knowledge, so much teaching, and how can we like dial it back to appreciating like what culture it came from and not maybe taking things from things that from other cultures that are like closed practices, and how can we better serve ourselves and like our healing and finding stuff that is like kind of made for us?
Absolutely. And on your website, you have, which is britcoke.com, you have several different products that are on there. 6 ways to decolonize self-care, reclaimed and radical, 50 actionable ways to resist, and then rooted rituals, woof, meaningful self-care practices from ancient native wisdom. So I'd like to talk about each one of these things and like your inspiration, just like a very brief like rundown, what inspired you to begin, writing this content beyond, begin publishing these and just kind of sharing them with the world, because two of them are actually free and people can download them directly from your website, correct? So walk me through 6 ways to decolonize self-care. I could read the description, but I would rather hear it directly from you. What inspired you to write this one? And then we'll jump into the other three as well.
Well, in January, I had kind of found my voice as far as like what I wanted to talk to on social about social media stuff and what we wanted to or essentially like what I wanted to bring to the table, which was decolonizing self-care, because I deeply know that it is so helpful, and I know I feel like a better person and more just like ready to take on the day and like motherhood and owning a small business and everything that goes on if I'm taking care of myself. And so I was like, okay, how can I talk about my culture in this? And I was thinking about all the things that I do that are from my culture and how some of those things are open practice and how can I bring them to the table to other people. And I realized quickly that most people don't know what decolonized self-care is. Like it's a term that is not used frequently. And so for 6 ways to decolonize self-care, the free download, I just kind of bring up 6 ways that you can do that, sort of like as an explainer opener into like my work, so that people kind of know what they're getting into. And like it has sort of like a good explanation of like what I talk about. And then as far as like the other free download, that is, I think it's called 50 Actionable Ways to Resist. I wrote that right after Trump came into office again, and I was like, okay, let's have a plan. What are things that people can do that are not like super time consuming, that are accessible, easy peasy, straightforward things that everyone can do. Because I find that, when we are constantly hearing all of the insanity that he and his people are doing, it gets really easy to shut down and be like, well, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to help. And so this is like a really quick, easy thing that I hope that everyone can use. And it's been downloaded a bonkers amount of times because I think we really are like looking for things to do that aren't like, maybe not everyone can like go out to protests or, make calls every day or whatever, but like you can do the things that are on the list.
Absolutely. And then reclaimed in radical and rooted rituals. These titles ring a bell, and people can purchase them directly on your website. So I want to do some more of like digging into, because we're getting into like the fall season, and I'm really into like spooky season. I'm really into like Halloween, and I'm really into like horror films and, everything pumpkin, everything pumpkin spice is literally everything. Which, speaking of which, if you haven't tried it, McDonald's has like this pumpkin like pie type thing that is so freaking good. But I'm just obsessed with everything fall. I think it's Halloween 365. That's just me. I grew up watching horror films. My mom is the total opposite than I am, but she will sit and watch. She'll watch like Michael Myers. But whenever we think about Halloween, we also think of like witchy vibes, right? And I think about also like just the fall time, just feeling that, that really crisp like October air. It's also a really good time to really focus on reflection from the year. Like what's happened from the year? Like how do we decompress? How do we move forward? We're getting ready to jump into the holiday season, Thanksgiving and Christmas and then the New Year. What are some ways that people can decompress without the colonization aspect?
I mean, I think that, by the way, I'm also a fall person. I love, love, love fall. And I get so excited about this time of year. I feel like it's such an interesting like energy of the year. And it's like a like you're saying, like it's a good time to reflect. And I think it's a good time to just sort of like reset as well. Like it's such a shift from summer to fall, for so many reasons. But I think a major thing that people can do is sort of just like, clearing energy, feeling like open your windows now that it's not going to be as hot every day. Like, let some fresh air in and, like light a candle, maybe get into some cinnamon and clove. Like, those are really like energy healing herbs. And I think it honestly does make us happier, which is like a big thing, like in the like witchy threads and TikToks that I watch and stuff, like people are talking about, like there's a reason that people like pumpkin spice. It's because, it is healing and it's like a protection spell or whatever. Like there's a reason we're drawn to those things. And like I was talking about smudging, like white sage, using white sage as a smudging vessel is like not open practice. And using other things like maybe sweetgrass or cedar or regular sage or other herbs that maybe your ancestral peoples used, like that is such a good way to sort of reset and like, maybe take a moment to journal or just take a moment to like close your eyes and just be outside and listen to the wind. And yeah. A big part of like what I share about is definitely using the four elements and being in nature when you can, and kind of just like shifting your mindset into slowing down and like taking that in, which is, I know, does not come naturally to most people. It's very hard for me. Like, really, up until a couple of years ago, I like did not at all understand meditation. I could not do it. My ADHD brain is not like made for that. And now that I've been practicing more like traditional styles of grounding and sort of inner healing and self-care, I am in a totally different place and I can actually do that. And it's probably a lot of things, just understanding why it's important versus like sort of making it a checklist item of like I should meditate. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm rambling at this point, but I enjoy fall and it's a great time to reset and it's a great time to listen to yourself and let yourself slow down so that you can ultimately accomplish the things that you want to do, community focused and bigger like a stratosphere of like activism and getting stuff done in that realm.
I love this rambling because it gives different ways that people can really just kind of decompress and like re-engage with your self-awareness and also like re-engage with, your feelings and your emotions and your thoughts. And it's a lot of those like that sustainability and the healing aspect, in like a survivor sense. My self-care was not necessarily the best self-care that I could have done. I got into drinking. I got into a drug addiction, and that was the way that I began my healing. But even though I wasn't actually healing, I felt like I was because I felt better. And I thought like the decompression and the way that I was feeling was I could associate that feeling with, other aspects, right? But and then I started going to therapy. And it really opened my eyes a lot. And I know a lot of people have been to therapy, and it goes one or two ways. It either helps or it further harms people, right? And I think a lot of it is
Yes.
because there are multiple aspects to it. I'm a big advocate for therapy, but I know in a lot of places, therapy is not accessible. Some insurances don't cover it. Some of it's like extremely expensive. Like if you look through like BetterHelp, it's like $40, $50 a session. But for a single parent working a waitress job, I think that's probably not going to be doable because then it comes down to, am I going to keep my lights on? Am I going to feed my children? Or am I going to go to therapy? And that's a very real reality. So I believe in like universal therapy, to be, there's a lot that goes into that. But what are your thoughts? What do you think?
Yeah, it's really interesting too, because I'm also reading Decolonizing Therapy right now, which is like a wonderful book. And I obviously being an Indigenous woman have felt very like closed off towards different medical attention and also therapy just because of those reasons. It's just not something that most therapists and doctors learn of like cultural significance of different things. And not only that, but just like how many medical studies and practices have just been essentially rooted in racism. And so I think it makes it really hard for people to open up and trust. And also culturally, as far as speaking to like native culture, so many of our grandparents, like, so I'm 37. So many of our grandparents, like, of that generation were still either had siblings in boarding schools or were in boarding schools themselves, which was essentially, attempting to kill our culture and our language and our heritage, our experience and learning from family members older than us, and created a ton of shame and fear in sharing the languages and histories and participating in traditions. And even as far as like in 1978, there was finally a law that released Native people into practicing ceremonies and traditions. So it has actually not been all that long ago that we've actually been able to just like fully express our culture legally. So, as far as I go, like I didn't learn a lot of my heritage from growing up, I think because that generation of people were essentially taught to be quiet and silent about their culture. So I learned a lot actually in college and beyond with access to books and the internet. And so It's just interesting how a lot of people from different cultures are quieted so much that we are not like, it doesn't come natural to open up and talk and to like walk through our experiences with like a therapist or something like that, because we're just so taught to be so inward, which I think is a big challenge for people. But all that to say, like, as far as like access to healthcare as well is just, you know, in shambles for so many people, for lots of political reasons and financial reasons, which also end up being political because minimum wage places are just, some are just still so insane, like say in Oklahoma, where we're still at whatever, 740 an hour. So it's hard for people to like advocate for themselves to be making like a livable wage. So yeah, it would be nice if everyone could have therapy, but I know that's not accessible. So part of the self-care that I'm talking about is like something that everyone can do. And I'm hoping to be able to like spread this knowledge so that other people realize they're not like, you're scrolling through Instagram and you're seeing people are like calling self-care like getting $10 lattes and like going to get a massage or like buying themselves shoes. Like that's not real self-care. That's colonized consumerism. And like the access to open practice Indigenous self-care is there. And I hope more people can start to use it and to care for themselves in ways that are practical and sustainable.
Abso-freaking-lutely. And you hit it right on the, because you hit it right on the nail, because I've been guilty of posting something like that. It's
Well,
like,
I think we
oh,
all
look,
have.
I'm,
It's not like a
absolutely.
bad thing, but it's like I think it like you know, it's especially hard, I think, too, like for parents to like see that and be like, well, you know, I can't just go do that for myself right now. I have like so many other responsibilities, or like I don't have childcare, or you know, the XYZ of it all. But like I hope to essentially just like make it so people realize that they can do true deep self-care and self-work and that it is accessible and you don't have to be like spending money to do it every time.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, is there anything else that you would like our listeners and our followers to know about decolonization and, decolonizing self-care? Is there anything else you'd like to talk about on that part?
The only other thing that comes to mind is really just like the appropriation of it all, as far as like, you know, different things that are like made so available and open to people like that seem aesthetically pleasing or like fine, because most people maybe don't know the origins of things. But like maybe taking a time to like look at like, okay, what kind of yoga are you doing? Where did it come from? Like, what can you learn about the culture and like why? Like, yoga is like sort of a form of protest in itself. And so, you know, and like things like smudging or things like sweat lodges and things that are just like taken and appropriated and sold to you by white people are like not okay to do. And some of the things that, you know, are popularized, like let's take a second and step back and like look at like what is this from? What culture is this from? How can maybe I approach it in a respectful way? That's what a lot of people will comment when I'm posting about this thing is like, I didn't want to appropriate, or is this okay for me to like buy this book if I'm white? Or, you know, like just kind of making it sure that they're being respectful about it. But like everything that I write is totally open, totally available to whoever is interested in learning. And I do have a section on like appropriation and my thoughts on that. And yeah, I mean that's all I can think of. Just like maybe step back and look at what you're doing and like where it came from, because like let's face it, we're in America, so many cultures are melded together here and like shared in ways maybe they shouldn't be sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And then how can people, if they want to get in touch with you or if they want to follow you on social media, what's the best way for people to contact you in case they have any further questions?
Absolutely. My socials are on, let me think about it for 1 second. So my Instagram and Threads is Brit L. Koch. And then my TikTok is Brit.coke. And then my email is britcokedp@gmail. So really any of those ways, I am on socials every day. And yeah, I would love to connect.
All right, perfect, Britt. Thank you so much for joining our podcast. And everybody out there, please be sure to contact Britt if you have any other questions about decolonization or any other self-care topics too. So feel free to reach out and then be sure to subscribe for more episodes. Thank you all so much and have a great day.